All right, I think we're up and running, I hope. We are looking at Perched, chapter 8 of Shoftim, and as I said last week, we get a very big letdown with not so much with Gideon himself, but the aftermath, what happens after he's gone. There is a very, very shocking story, and I'm going to set the homework already to read chapters 9 and 10. I'm not here next week, so you have kind of a week off, so you can look ahead. Perek Tet is one of the strangest stories in the whole of the Bible. Gideon's the son from a pelegesh. How do you translate the word pelegesh? Not a wife, a concubine. I think that's the expression that is used. He becomes there. It's an unbelievable thing that happens. I mean, I don't even want to sort of tell you in advance. It's something you just, if you never read the story, you should read this ahead. Chapter 9, and see what happens to him. A guy called Avimelech. And it's kind of an attempt to establish kingship at a time when they weren't ready for it, and you see that instead of getting kingship, they get anarchy. It's an interesting chapter to study for people doing political science. I had a student at Stern College who was a political science major, and I said to him, you should write your paper on something that you're learning in Shoftim, because you can write about political science in the ancient world. You know, things that go on, the politics is really very, very, how should we say, things haven't changed, plus or change, right? So it's things are not that different in those days to what it is today. Before we get to that, let's just see what happens to Gideon. We're looking at chapter 8, and what we will deal with is one of the, again, a very strange mindset of Gideon at the end of everything, when he's conquered the Midianim and everything is happening, and you'll see that there are certain groups that don't really relate to him very well. People don't accept him as a leader, and he establishes his authority. He does something very, very strange. He makes some sort of icon. He makes a real image, which becomes, not necessarily when he's alive, although there's an argument around that, but after he dies, it becomes idolatrous. And it's very strange to try and understand why he makes this image. We'll see the psukim. We'll just read through quickly chapter 8. And then we'll try and understand what exactly is going on, because it's really unbelievable. All right, Perek Chet. So we're looking at the following. So Yomer Abish Ephraim, firstly, Gideon has a political problem. The political problem was that he made an army and excluded the people of Ephraim. One suspects there was a bit of, how should we call it, nepotism going on here. He was from the tribe of Manasseh. And there's going to be a whole theme over here that Ephraim was always the one that was favored over Manasseh. Right? Remember, with the hand. Okay? And therefore, what happens is that Gideon over here, in the course of setting up his army, did not include Ephraim. Right? He brought them on later when they were chasing the two princes. Then Ephraim got involved. But he wasn't actually there at the beginning of the battle. So Ephraim now comes to complain. That Yomelovash Ephraim, Matavazah Sita Lanul, Vilti Kurot Lanul. You didn't call us to war. Ki Alachta Lachem Ben Midian. You went to fight Midian. The Ereven of Itabachoskim, you had this tremendous battle. Why didn't you call us? Right? We're brothers in arms. But Yomer Aleihem, Mel Siti Atak Kachem. He teaches something very smart. Instead of defending himself, he actually... It's not going to happen. It's not happening over there. He said, Mel Siti Atak Kachem. What have I done like you? In other words, he goes on the offensive. He says that you guys did something great because they caught the princes. Remember last week, they were chasing Orev and Ze'ev, and who caught them? The men of Ephraim, because they came down afterwards and joined in the chase. So he's telling them, you wanted to be part of the battle. You had, what does this remind me of? It's Galilee, right? You know, Gemara says that you do Galilee, you get the Zechut, all the Kriya, the whole reading of the Torah, because you wind it up at the end. So what we're saying over here is that the Ephraim, who managed to catch the princes at the end, they get the merit of the whole battle, according to Gideon. Okay? Halo tov olot Ephraim b'tzir Abiezer. Right? The olot Ephraim, the gleanings of Ephraim, are better than the b'tzir, than the harvest of Abiezer. He was known as Abiezer. So basically what he's saying is that as far as he's concerned, what Ephraim did was greater. You capture those two princes. What can I do like him? Buttering them up. He is absolutely buttering up the people of Ephraim. And as soon as they heard that, they became softer towards him as it were. When they heard what he was saying, they got their honor, okay, they had the dinner in honor of Ephraim, and everybody was happy. And that's basically the story. It's kind of kind of an interesting thing. Gideon seems to have learned the art of political discussion, political compromise, etc. Fine. If he comes to the Arden, over who Shloshmiyot the Isha Sheitav, he wrote him. He still got the 300 men with him. Remember, he went down from 32,000 to 300, and these guys are still with him. They're still chasing, and these guys, as you can imagine, are very exhausted, right? And what happens? Here comes something very strange. He asked for support from the men of Sukkot. We're not even told what tribe they were. And interestingly, he brings in the note in the English version here, Sukkot means thorns. It seems to be that they lived up to their name, or lived down to their name. They're very thorny people. Alright? They were not people that you could really get on with very well. And we saw this at the beginning of Sefer Shoftim, that there was an issue in Am Yisrael of chesed between the tribes. The tribes don't seem to relate to each other in a very nice way. They become very territorial. Okay? And what happens is, as a consequence of that, when Gideon goes to ask the men of Sukkot for help, and he says, "Ki ayetim hem, help my men, they're tired, but anochi v'zevach v'zevach v'salmuna, malchi v'midian, are now facing the kings of Midian, these guys v'zevach v'salmuna, v'yom esarei Sukkot." So what do the princes say of this place? "Hakaf v'zevach v'salmuna, atav yadecha, have you caught them? Ki yitain v'tzvach halachim, we'll give you bread?" In other words, go and do your job, and then we'll feed you afterwards. Not very nice. You know, I mean, they're only asking for some sustenance to keep going and to fight the battle, or to complete the battle which they started. And the men of Sukkot did not want to know. But Yomer Gideon, and Gideon has to react. Again, how do you deal with this? All right? So he deals with it, I suppose, like a principal of a high school. But Yomer Gideon, Rachem, Betet Hashem, Et Zevach Hamuna, when I do catch them, the Dashti Et Betachem, then you're going to get it. Basically, I'm going to tread all over you. Dashti means I'm literally going to winnow. Dash is one of the 39 melachot on Shabbat.
Thrash.
I'm going to thrash you all. Et kotseya midbar et abarkin. I'm going to use thorns and briars, I think is the translation, whatever a briar is. Basically, you know, you didn't help me out. I am now exerting my authority. You are in trouble. And no reaction, all right? They basically shut the doors. It's interesting that you find this theme again and again and again. Later on, with David HaMelech, he's running around with his 400 men. Okay, remember the story then. He's running away and Shaul is chasing him and there's a whole big problem over there. And he goes to a place called Nov Ir HaKohanim. And the same story, he's looking for sustenance. And the difference, of course, by the time you get to that period in Jewish history, they help him. The trouble is, of course, that it was against the will of the king. The king considered the help to be rebellious because Shaul considered David to be Rodef, he considered to be a rebel against the king. He was a rebel against the king. And as a consequence of that, Nebuch, the whole town of the Kohanim, were killed. Chapter 21, 22 of Shmuel. And it's, again, the same sort of interesting situation that when it came to these groups of men and having to represent Kaisel or their own interests or whatever, they expected the other people to support them, and afterwards David is sorry for what he did, because he knows that as a consequence of what he did, he brought about that terrible destruction of the city of Canaan. So it's not a theme which we only find once, we find it in a number of places. The idea that they go and they expect the rest of the nation, wherever they end up, to support them at least with a bit of bread, you know, what's so wrong with this? Where's the chesed? The answer is that unfortunately in this time period, particularly now, chesed was not one of their big pastimes. They weren't big into chesed. They were big into growing tomatoes. Okay, they were big into planting whatever they needed to plant. They weren't big in doing chesed, and it's really quite shocking. Okay, you know, asking for a bit of bread, nothing more. It's very, very distressing this. And Gideon establishes authority and he says to them, you've not supported me, you'll pay the price. And he goes to another place. The Yarnisham Penuel goes to Penuel. The Dabalem Kazod, his same request. The Yarnot Anshe Penuel Kashemut Anu Anshe Sukkot, the same response. Penuel doesn't want to know, and Sukkot do not want to know. Vayomer gam l'anshei pinu l'emor, so the same reply from Gideon, b'shuvi b'shalom, when I come back, epotzad migdal, as they had a big tower there, some sort of protective tower that they built in a place called Penuel, and Gideon said, when I come back, I'm going to destroy the tower. You think that you are invincible, right, that you've got this migdal, you had it, you're going to be destroyed. V'zevach v'tzalmuna v'karkor v'machameyem imam v'chameshet asar elef, kol ha'notorim v'kol machalei b'nei kedem, v'anof l'meh v'esim elef ish sholei chayim. And now we're going to see what's left. They have essentially, the zevach v'tzalmuna have chamesh asar elef, then they have 15,000 men left. And nevertheless, look what happens. V'yal gidon derech ha'shchunei b'olim, y'kedem l'novach v'yodbar, gidon goes in a certain path. V'yal chet ha'machameh v'machameh yod betah. He again wipes out the camp. What is interesting at this point, there's no suffering. Remember, he always had a doubt. God, give me a sign, right? So he had the fleece, and then last week, you know, he has to go and he's afraid. Hashem says, if you're afraid, go down to the camp and see what they're talking about. At this point, there's no more signs, which becomes very interesting. It makes the end of the chapter even more perplexing. Because at this point, you get the impression that Gideon has really matured. He's come to the point now where he's really doing the leadership thing very, very well. He's taken rebellion and he told them, you know, you think you're going to get away with this, you're not going to get away with it. The shofet is the rule. The shofet is the law. Moed b'malchut, moed b'shofet. If you rebel against the shofet, it's like being rebelling against the king. And you're going to pay the price. And as a consequence of all of that, Gideon's stature becomes very, very strong. The problem is, of course, as I said later on, it becomes very difficult what he does at the end. But I note, and I want to mention this, that there's no question now of him waiting for signs, waiting for Hashem to say, do this, don't do this. He's gone ahead and he's attacked the camp, clearly outnumbered, and it doesn't matter. God is on his side, and he wins. All right? Possibly bed, these two kings run away, and he runs after them, and he catches them, and he destroys the whole camp. Unbelievable, 300 men. Right, these guys are really working very hard. Vayoshev Gideon ben Yoash, Milan Uchamai, comes back from the war, Milamale Acharas, from, there's different translations here, whether it's the name of a place, or it seems to be that the sun is still in the sky, and that's the translation. He catches one of the young people of Sukkot, the place that rejected him the first time. He writes down for him, this young man writes down all the names of all the princes, and all the elders, Shivim v'Shiva Ish, 77 men. And what happens as a consequence of Yavol Kolan Shei Sukkot, Vayomi in Ezevach Tamuna, they all come to meet him, and he shows them the king, the two kings that he's captured. Gideon shows it to them. Asher cherafte moti leman. He says very strong words. He says, you make fun of me. You said, Akav zelo tamuna tabi yadecha. Ki niten lan ashecha ayyifim lachan. And you refuse to give us bread? Here they are. Vayikachet zigmei ha'ir. Vekotzei ha'midbar v'edbar kanim. V'yodah behem el shei sukkah. Basically, he thrashed them the way he promised to do so. All right? No mercy. This is very, very violent. Okay, this is no messing around here. And it's clearly the concept of Moriba Marcus, and he's allowed to do this. He's really establishing incredible authority. Gideon, in the end, turns out to be really one of the strongest leaders in terms of political leadership, right? We're not talking on the spiritual side, although I'm arguing that that goes together with this, because there's a confidence now in Gideon which we didn't see before. All right, he's tremendously confident, which we didn't see in chapter 7, certainly not the beginning of chapter 6. All right, and interesting, and of course the other tower he knocks down, Migdal Penuel Natatri Aroget Anshei, and he kills all the men. All right, this is very harsh. And now he's got to deal with the kings, the enemy kings. He basically makes a claim to them. I'm not sure where. Oh, there you go. A little corner over here. This is known as the intimate gathering. Provided that you can get to the seat. It's so intimate that you actually, you got to fly there. All right, again, so he basically brings his claim against the kings. He says, where are the men that you killed in Tavor? In other words, clearly there was some sort of battle when Zevach and Tamura, the two kings of Midian, were involved, and Jews were killed. And they said, as you are, so were they. One was as the form of the children of the king. Basically, that they're saying, as far as this goes, the Gideon is making a claim against them, and they don't really have any sort of response. It's kind of, again, you look at the Mephoshim here, exactly what they're saying, but the bottom line is that he's basically saying to them, you're responsible for the death of these people, now you will pay the price. These are the sons of my mother, in other words, the people that you kill. Alright? Yes. And basically, it seems to be that Zerach and Salmona were responsible for killing some very close relatives of Gideon, maybe members of his tribe, we're not quite sure, and this is their punishment. Yomel Yester B'charos, he has a firstborn called Yester, and he says, you've got to now go and do the deed. Very reminiscent later on with Doeg. Alright, again, we're going back to that story with Shaul. Okay, Shaul looks for people to kill the Kohanim, and he asks a whole bunch of people, they all refuse. Alright, and eventually Doeg, the only one of his men who goes ahead and does it. And there's a big question mark about this gentleman Doeg, something to think about when we actually, please go if we ever get to that stage. But listen to this, his firstborn says, "V'lo shalaf ana chabo ki yarei kedanana," he didn't want to do it. He didn't want, you know, he had not yet raised his sword, seemingly, in this way, and he was afraid. So the king said, "Gideon, this is, you've got to do it. You've got to kill us." I presume they were hoping that if the son was afraid, he wouldn't do it either. The father wouldn't. Because you're the strong guy. He did kill them. And similarly, they had some sort of decoration on the camel's neck. They had some sort of gold decoration around their necks, translated as crescent. All right, this is not the sort of the crescent of Islam. Right? This is way before Islam. But they seem to have had around the neck of their camels. And remember, we read last time that the camels were like, who knows, you know, millions. I mean, that's the sort of impression one got, thousands for sure. And all of this gold was taken. Now here comes the thing which is so strange. Gideon is tremendously strong. He's made a tremendous statement of authority. He's taken over. He has proved himself in battle. He's proved himself in faith. He's got a relationship with God. He's got a relationship. Now he's actually sort of subdued the people. People are now fearing him. This is where it gets very strange. Vayomer ish Yisrael Gideon, Meshol bono gam ata, gam mincha gam ben benecha, the Jews accept him now. You, your son, and your grandson, which of course is not the style of Shofet. This is really looking towards Malchus, and this is a big mistake, as you'll see when you look at chapter 9. Ki oshatana miyad Midyan, because you've saved us from Midyan. Vayomelem Gideon, lo imshol ani bachem, I will rule over you, lo imshol ani bachem, Hashem imshol bachem. This is tremendous stuff. Alright, God is going to rule over you, Hashem is the ruler, and we are not, essentially I think what he's saying is, you want a dynasty, we're not yet ready for dynastic rule at this point. But who is really ruling? Hashem Yimshol Bachem. Alright, this is great. I mean, he's really laying it to them. So Gideon said, I've got one question. One request, please give me your rings that you have, the nose rings or whatever they are, of the spoil. Kimizmezav Lahem. They had a whole bunch of these gold rings. Ki Yishmaelim hay, because the people that they overtook were Yishmaelim, who apparently had this as a kind of decorative thing that they used. Either they wore it, or they had it on their animals, or whatever. They opened up some sort of container, so like a big blanket, or a big sheet, or whatever, and they threw their Ishnez and Shlalo, all of the spoil. Now here comes something very weird. It was very heavy, 1,700 weights of gold, dinars, which is a tremendous amount of gold. Levad min asaranim anetivah. This is apart from what he took from the camels, right? All of that gold. Ubigdei argaman and the clothing she'al malchei midyan, which the kings were wearing. Levad min anakot asher tzavrei gemalehem, and the other things that they had around their necks, chains or whatever it was. And here Gideon does something really weird. Vayas oto Gideon le'ephod. He made it into an ephod. All right, now, you ask me, what is an ephod? Okay, with a ph in the middle, E-P-H-O-D. What is an ephod? Ephod is something we read about with the Kohen Gadol. It's the cloak or whatever. So what Gideon did is that, and we're going to see in a minute exactly what he did, or rather we're going to see why he did it. He turned this gold into a gold equivalent of the ephod that everyone would recognize as being the garment of the Kohen Gadol. Some say that the ephod was actually the belt in this case. He made like a very ornate, it must be incredibly ornate, gold belt, right? This is a ton of gold. Whichever way you understand it, what is Gideon doing over here? Okay, yeah, what does it remind you of? When they were in the Midbar, they were having a terrible plague of snakes. So what did Hashem say to Moshe? Yeah, you make the Nechash HaNechosha, that serpent of copper, you hold it up, right? And the people looked upwards, and of course the famous thing of looking up to Shammai, and they were healed, they didn't die. Alright, and of course this Nechash HaNechosha was preserved, and eventually the Gemara says, I think it was, which king was it? Chizkiyot. King Hezekiah basically hid the whole thing. He had to grind it up, because it was idolatrous. People started, you know, worshipping the image, right? And here, Gideon is leading the people into some sort of dangerous situation. He's making an ephod out of all of the gold, all right? Let's just see what the Pasuk says. But he had segotel be'iro ba'ofra, and he puts it on show. He makes an exhibition, okay? You know, with sort of a mission free, I presume. And everyone can go in Ofra, which is where he comes from. They use nu kol b'nei Yisrael acharav sham. And the word they use nu is, of course, a very bad word. Yuznu, the idea either of zinut in the, not in the sense of immorality here, but in the sense of mazon, feasting their eyes on this. They yuznu, they had a, but of course it's got a negative connotation where they were indulging eventually in some sort of idolatrous worship. They healed Gidon, they told Mokesh, and of course this is Shmuel writing this, and he says this became a stumbling block for Gidon. And of course the question is, why, you know, in the name of whatever, did he make this thing? Why did he make it? He could have donated a very nice donation to the temple. He could have made some sort of tremendous thing for the Mishkan, alright? It does show you, by the way, how uncentral, or whatever the word is, non-central the Mishkan really was. You get that sense at the beginning of Shmuel Aleph, where Elkanah, the famous husband of Hannah, Hannah, as everybody knows, the woman who prayed. But her husband, we don't know much about him, but we're told in Midrash that he generated enthusiasm for the Mishkan. He used to go around, he was like the Pied Piper of Hannah, I love that story. And he generated the people to go up for the Mishkan, because they weren't going. People just didn't want to know. You know, there was like a few people trickling in, and this Mishkan was there for hundreds of years, and it became almost neglected by the nation, and Elkanah couldn't stand it. So he brought people to the Mishkan. So until Elkanah, it's quite clear that the Mishkan was really not very well attended. Right? Aliyah LeRegel, not even. They didn't go. It just was not. It was something in the Midbar. It got into Eretz Yisrael. It became like a quaint thing. I suppose you went to see it, you know, once in your life. You know, you go to the Metropolitan Museum once. That's enough, right? It's such a big place. Or wherever, the British Museum. British Museum, you go a few times. It's a good place. But Metro, I bet I find British Museum more interesting. But whatever, it's not much more than that, and that's it. And they didn't go. So here, clearly Gideon did not see any value, or seemingly, to make some sort of a donation, taking the gold and handing it over to the Mishkan. That was not what he wanted to do. He made an ephod. This is really weird. It's really strange. And look what it says. It became Mokesh. We'll just finish the chapter, and then I'll just show you some sources here. So the Midianites became subdued. They couldn't raise their head. And there was peace for 40 years. So from the point of view of retaining the peace of Eretz Israel, that was achieved almost without question. He goes home. Gidon, he had 70 sons, busy guy. And again, some people argue that maybe he was already, how should we say, it was not acceptable what he was doing. He was marrying a lot of women, and maybe this was not the sort of example that he was meant to set. He had one concubine. Yozalogam, he, Ben, she gave him a son, and Shemo Avimelech, and this is the guy Avimelech that hopefully when you read chapter 9, you'll find out all about him. He was very old when he died. He was in the family plot that he was buried. But Ofra via Ezri in the place called Ofra. Straight away they go back to idolatry. And they made Baal Brit for a god. This is the name of the idol. ולא יזכרו בני ישראל את השם לכן, remember God, המציל אותם מיד כל הזה מסביב, save them, ולא עשו חסד. And this is again one of the psukim which is so important. They did not do kindness. In Beit Yubal, Gidon, וכל הטובה שעשה מישראל. He was, that did tremendous things for the Jewish people, they did not respond to him. Presumably that means when he died, like when Yeshua died, there was no hesped, there was no mourning period that they should have had, nothing. And Am Yisrael at this point, what, again, we see it again and again, tremendously self-centered. They were really just interested in their own ba'amot, their own little piece of land that they were developing, the area that shaved this one and shaved that, and nothing more than that. And it's very, very distressing, very disturbing. What's going on with this aphid? I just want to show you this very quickly. We don't have a lot of time. Let me pass these around. This is very, very strange. Again, anyone want to suggest? You know, I can throw it open to the floor. Why did he make this aphid? What was he trying to do with it? I mean, what was it about? Sorry, again? Zichron Tru'ah, because of the shofar. But why would the aphid represent that? Why would the aphid do that? Good evening. Yeah, I don't know. It's Kangolo. Alright, so shofar and Kangolo is not really a theme that goes together. Alright, if it was, I'm just trying to think, you know, had it been something which had been more in the theme of the victory, had been in the theme of using something which was more priestly, then I would have understood. Right, if he used something which the Kohen, or worn something which the Kohen Gadol would wear. But it doesn't really relate. It's very strange. It's really, really strange. I've got on the page here, there's at least five, possibly six explanations of initially what he's doing. And once we try and understand what he's doing, the first thing we have to understand is there any suggestion that this was in fact an idolatrous act by Gidon? Right? Now, clearly not. And that's and what I'll do immediately, right, is throw at you what it says over here at the end, at the bottom of the page, because this is very disturbing. Reshit Rabbah, the Midrash, for one, and I can't explain it to you, right at the bottom of the page, the Seva Tova, remember it says he lived a long line, Omar Resh Lakish, I think it is, Gimohem Shanem Abahem Seva, three people lived a very long line, says the word Seva, Avraham Veshavelo, Avraham was worthwhile, David Veshavelo, David also, he was a good guy, Gidon Velo Shavelo. Gidon, but it wasn't worth it that he lived so long. Why? Lama, Vayasoto Le'efod, Lavodat Tochavim. So far as this Midrash is concerned, he made the Efod. Now again, is the Midrash saying that he did it for idolatrous reasons? I can't come to terms with that. I can't come to terms with Gidon after all that we've said and the confidence that he has, and he says, Hashem Yimshol Bachem, that he's now making an Efod and it's a bit idolatry. It doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense. It can't be right. But here we see that maybe, I don't know if the Midrash is trying to suggest it, that it's potentially idolatrous, as opposed to intending it to be idolatrous. Yeah, right. What happens is it's potentially idolatrous. Mm-hmm. And of course it shows how careful you have to be when, you know, you're involved in something like this, you know, your intentions and everything else are really very, very important and not just intention, you've got to lay out the agenda so clearly. And seemingly Gidon did not lay out his agenda the way he should have done. And it's very distressing. It really is distressing. Yeah.
Perhaps he acted unilaterally. He said, give it to me, and he fashioned it. He didn't discuss it with the Chachamim, the Zkenim.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I agree with that. But the question, again, still is, why? What is he doing here? What is going through his mind to do this? Let's look at some of the commentaries here, just to understand what this aphod is about. Number one. Alright, I've written the names on the side. This is taken from the Amboes. It's a book which I've spoken about maybe before, but it's one of those books you really need to get to know. It's in the library downstairs. It's commentary on the whole of the Bible. Phenomenal commentary. I think the rabbi lived about 300 years ago. Yaakov Kuli, I think his name was. Lived in Morocco, I think. And he put together every possible source that you could ever wish to have, and a lot of stuff which you probably would never get your hands on, because he had access to Midrashim, which I'm not even sure if we have the original manuscripts today. You know, he had sort of books which they had in his library in Morocco, which were very maybe unavailable to us today. It's very interesting. And what essentially we see from Amloes is a whole string of commentaries here, right, trying to understand what this ephod is about. So initially, as I said at the top, did he sin or not? All right? To suggest even that he did a sin by this, it certainly would not be, as you say, b'mezid. He wouldn't have done it on purpose to do an avera. But the question is, what was he doing? So Rashi initially, a perish arisha, all right, which is all, this is taken from Amloes, you'll see it's the fourth line down, where it says Rashi, number one. HaPerish HaRishon She'asayfo L'Zechat Shua Gedola. It was like a memorial to the great salvation She'asah Shem Yitbarach Al Yado, which God had performed through him. She'al Yidei Ribun Zamin, because there were all these nose rings, right, which were an enormous amount of stuff. Yaru Kulam Ma Rav Asum HaYachel Midyan. People would see the size of the gold of what they captured and realize how big the army of Midian was. Sheikh Niem Hashem Yitbarach Bidei Gidon, which God had subdued through Gidon. So this is clearly, you know, at the end of the battle, you make some sort of monument to the victory. Okay, I don't know, like you know, you think of around the world. There's a lot of these things in Russia. I remember in all the monuments to various victories. Now you can probably tell me more about that. Than I seem to remember in Moscow there were a number of interesting monuments like that all over the country. The victory of communism over fascism, usually, right? That's what it was. And this was maybe sort of the idea. But again, not idolatry. According to Rashi, it was a zecher l'tshuva. Okay, and again, doesn't really explain why he would do this, but I suppose we can understand this. He wants to give a future generation some sort of indication what it was like. I don't know if they still exist on the Tel Aviv highway. Those of you who made that drive or ridden the bus, and you remember those burnt out vans that, you know, if you, again, I mentioned the movie last week, Cast a Giant Shadow, it's in that movie, shows you what happens is that these are the vans that they used to try and keep the road to Jerusalem open in 1947-48, and the Arabs, it's unbelievable how they were literally ambushed on every trip that they made, and in many cases though they didn't survive. They threw bombs and they threw Molotov cocktails at them, and these vans blew up and people were killed in. And they always kept them on the side of the highway. I read recently, I think a number of them were taken away because they just now got so rusty that they couldn't preserve them anymore. Whether they're in a museum somewhere, I just don't know. But there again, you know, this was left there because it gave you some indication when you're driving up to Yerushalayim, which you take for granted so easy. Once upon a time, it wasn't so straightforward. You had to go through a barrage of bullets and who knows what just to go to Yerushalayim, you know, on a daily basis, and most people obviously will not even attempt to make that trip. It's very moving, that monument. So that's one suggestion. That's Rashi. Number two, Abarbanah, what does he say? Pirush Hasheni, the second suggestion, Shala'ach she'Yisrael itichah melucha lo, u'lezaro adolav. Right? What happened was that Israel, the Jews had promised Gidon to be the king, they offered him the kingship. He made this ephod, which was made out of the gold which was worn in the noses of the enemy, which is near to the mouth. Alright, this is a very, very diverse concept. Lirmoz, it was a kind of hint, ala tachatam, for their promise, to remind them that they promised him the kingship. That's very far-fetched. With all due respect, usually Don Yitzchak Abarbanel is very on the ball. He's on the mark. And in this case, boy, he's almost Hasidic, and I think he'd probably kill me for saying it, but that's the way it is. You know, he was one of the great Spanish rabbis of the 14th century, but in this case, wow, it's a bit remote. That's another suggestion about what the ephod was. HaPirush HaShlishi, the Rabbag, Shasaifa the Malbushlo, Kederach Matzpiim Agadolim, right? It seems to be like great soldiers. Halov Shim Malbushim Yuchadim Laot Siman Agdulatam. It was a sign of greatness. He made himself a tremendous coat made out of gold. I don't know how he could actually wear it, because it would probably, you know, you'd start disappearing into the ground. It would force you down. The Lo Nitkaven La Sobo of Odizorach Hasushalam. Rabbi says no concept here of idolatry. Elash Yisrael Nichshu Rabbi Asman. What happened afterwards? The Jewish people became fell down because of this. It was their problem. It wasn't Gidon's creation in the sense Gidon did not lead them to idolatry. They came to it themselves. Pirush HaRevi, the Alshich, who's again 16th century sort of mainstream in Poland. He says, Shulaya Sakena Shem Anes, Shanasai Sabrai Rashi. It's to do with the miracle. Shekeshem Sha'efer Mechapel Ovan Avodazar. Interestingly, the Efer was the atonement of the high priest for idolatry. He used to wear that on Yom Kippur, and it atoned for the sin of idolatry. Kach, lo hibit HaKadosh Baruch Hu ba'Oven Avodah Zarah. So too, God did not look at the sin of Avodah Zarah, which came before Gidon. V'zochah et ha'efer HaKohen HaGadol, and he remembered this Efer of the great, of the high priest. V'tzilo mi'ad Midyan, and they were saved from the hands of Midyan. That's why Gidon makes an ephod, a copy of the garment from the spoil. It's in fact to stop them returning to idolatry, which really fits in so well to the concept. It's not Gidon causing idolatry, it's Gidon trying to stop idolatry. But of course the problem is that he, you know, what possesses him to do this when the danger is that they could get idolatrous from it? They could actually turn it into an idol. It's so strange that he would not realize, right? He would not understand that the danger of it becoming an idol is very great. So again, all of the rabbis, as you can see, are very perplexed by what he was doing. It's some sort of sign. It's some sort of memorial. It's some sort of reminder of what the Kohen Gadol represents, the cloak of the Kohen Gadol, whatever it may be. Well, just look at the last commentary. Ha'perish ha'chamishi. Which is a Riyaz Zaken of Tosfot, and this is really shocking, Shehaya Avodah Zarah, that he did it for idolatrous reasons. Now that's unbelievable. The one of the Tosfot, which is very early, grandson, Riyaz Zaken was one of the grandsons of Rashi, I think. That's a good question. Vahaya Medaber Al Pi Keshafim, and he used it to speak, as it were, using some sort of magic to communicate. And he used it to bring, as it were, messages from the idols, you know, using some sort of magic formula or whatever. Don't ask me what this is about, and I don't even know where the Tosafist gets it from, but that is very, very shocking. And be perfectly honest, I don't know why he says that. I don't know where this actually, the reference is. I haven't looked it up in the original source. It's the same. And it's really, it's shocking to suggest that there would be a concept here of Gidon indulging in some sort of idolatrous response to everything that happened to him is really very, very shocking indeed. So I don't know what I bring to your attention. I'm happy to say that he's outnumbered by the other rabbis. Yeah,
that's the Gemara, Omar Reish Lakish.
Yeah, which essentially is what he bases it on. That's where he gets it from. But the whole concept. And again, you ask yourself, what is the Gemara saying? I mean, the Gemara is clearly saying that the end proves the means. In other words, because he became idolatrous, therefore you have to say that he was the cause of idolatry. But I'm so uncomfortable with even considering Gidon, you know, thinking in those terms because of the way the language that he uses here. Miyim sholvachem, Hashem sholvachem. Lo ani, velo ben, lo beni. God is your ruler, you know, I mean, and then to say that he makes an ephod and is becoming idolatrous, or he tends idolatry, it doesn't follow. It just doesn't work. Yeah.
That's what I understand. Why would he even think that they would create something idolatrous out of this?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, let's put it this way. I'll ask the question the other way. Why would he think that they would not create? In other words, what was going through his mind?
They could have made it something
idolatrous. Yeah, I think you have to say that the danger of something being made idolatrous is a constant danger because of the, you know, we've got the background, right? Look at what happened in chapter 6, chapter 5, chapter 4. It's coming back again and again. The biggest yitzhahara of those days was idolatry. What I think is much more of a challenging question in the sense that on the same lines is to try and understand why Gidon would not be worried about this thing becoming idolatrous. If he's made it, and we're going to assume, like majority of the opinions over here, it was a memorial for the victory, then for goodness sake, why does he not worry that it can become idolatrous? In the Torah, the Nechash Nechoshet was there, and clearly, maybe by this time, there's already signs that, you know, things were not exactly the way they should have been amongst the people, and they've already got a precedent for something which may become, or maybe was already becoming idolatrous. So why would Gidon not worry about this?
Well, did he create this in order to pay tribute to God?
That's the suggestion, and clearly from his point of view, that would be his rationale.
That's what he thought that the people were there for.
Excellent. The problem is that you're dealing with people who are not necessarily, you can't program them, right? You can't program them to think. I think what we're going to suggest, we're going to say something very radical. And this is, again, I'm going to suggest this to you, and I'll see how you go with this.
I just want to say something. Go ahead. Didn't everybody notice that there were 300 soldiers?
Yeah.
Didn't they realize that it was Hashem?
Yeah, it had to be.
If you make something and memorialize such a victory, you would think it's the opposite.
Yeah.
Right. And look at it and say, only 300, look what happened,
yeah.
And that he would remember this and maybe...
Yeah, it's so strange. The answer to your question is that we don't understand the Yetzer Hara of Avodah Zarah. That's clear. We don't understand it. There was a Yetzer Hara to serve idolatry which came back at them, and it was like a spring. The more you tried to push it away, the harder it came back at you when it rebounded. Right? It was just unbelievable. Idolatry was something which really was, it was in the bloodstream. You couldn't get away with it. All right? You couldn't get away from it, and it was always there. And Gideon doesn't seem to sense that this Ephod would eventually become idolatrous like everything else. And the question again, to me, the biggest question of all is really, why didn't he have that sensitivity? We're going to suggest something. I just want to share this with you. A lot of what we've said is I've used this Sefer, this Rav from Israel. Unfortunately, he's no longer alive. Unfortunately, Rav Levy. I teach a lot of his stuff in Stern College as well. And he suggests like this. I'll just read this paragraph to you. He says, Umagaram lo shelo yireh ha-sakana. What was the cause that Gideon would not see the danger? He yisalkah me'aderech miyot lo mokesh, and stop this becoming a stumbling block to him, to his family, to Israel. Why did Gideon not understand that this was dangerous? Making this image, which eventually, as the Pasuk says, as soon as he died, maybe even before he died, it became idolatrous. Listen to this. Ulai mitan lansbir kotzeri ato b'rezim. Gideon was not, he's using the expression in Hebrew, short-sighted, but not in the mishkafah, not in the glasses.
Sorry to interrupt you. We're having a walk at time.
I'm sorry, in the middle of a shiur, so maybe at the end. Another 5 minutes. Really another 5 minutes. Okay. Again, Ulai mitan lahazbir kotzeri ato b'rezim, the short-sightedness of Gideon is to be understood as follows. Gideon do'ad l'shalom shifto. One of the things we're going to say, it's actually on the sheet that I gave you, I just didn't read this. Gideon was always worried about his tribe. We already spoke a bit about this. Gideon came from the tribe of Manasseh. Manasseh was the tribe, I suppose, the brother that fell kind of left out of it. You know, with the hands already from Yaakov, he put the hand on Ephraim, and Manasseh was kind of pushed to the back. Yisimcha lekim k'Ephraim k'Manasseh, right? Ephraim comes before Manasseh. The bracha we sang Friday night. And Manasseh was always considered to be on the lower end of the tribe. Gideon now becomes the leader of Kohen Yisrael. He's from the tribe of Manasseh. So he is very proud of his achievement. And he wants to do things for his tribe. What does he do for his tribe, which is remarkable? He wants them to be seen by the rest of the nation as being something strong, something worthwhile. So what does he do? He makes a memorial in Ophra, which is the capital, as it were, of the Sheta, of the area which represents Manasseh. And he makes this memorial, and therefore he tries to give them a bit of status, because it's like the garment of the Kohen Gadol. And all the time, what is Gideon really doing? He's trying to preserve, and he's trying to establish, and trying to increase the prestige of the tribe of Manasseh. Very interesting. And he says like this, Sheshemo chaseh be'ephod. And not only that, but the ephod on which the breastplate was sitting, the name, the tribe that was missing on the stones was Manasseh. So Gideon now tries to make up for lost time. That's incredible. What was Gideon's real problem? You know, I always argue that you don't need to learn the Siddur Sharon to get Musa. You got it from the Tanakh. You got it from the Navi. The Navi is saying over here, you know what Gideon's problem was? He was biased. He wanted to give his tribe a boost. He wanted to see them sort of, you know, representative of greater things than they were. They weren't treated very well. And Gideon wanted them to become great. And because of that great desire to do that, Nogea Badavai became too involved, he became too biased, and he just did not see the consequences of making an Eitzah. Unbelievable. But Ulai Nagia Zush, Ulai Lo Eitzah Mudad Lo Klal, maybe he wasn't even aware of it. This bias that he had, he Sheman Ami Menu Lifoki, the boy, it caused him to do things which were not right. Oh, Kibbutz Shikulo L'Tavat Shita, because he was doing this for the sake of his tribe, making an Eitzah, giving them status. Lo Hayam Mesugal Lachzot Kvar Yer Sakana Ruchanit Kaisa. He did not see what the danger was for the Jewish people. The Eitzah was good for him, it was good for everybody. The reality was it was good for his tribe and absolutely disastrous for everybody else. Because they would look at it and say, wow, you know, this is a sign of who knows what, and it has powers, and the next thing you know, before you look around, everybody's worshipping the Eitzah, which is exactly what happened. And this is a message here. L'lamedecha, if you want a bit of Musa, kama kasher v'narai midat hanigia. When you're biased, when you're always blinded by a bias. And the Pasuk says that this became for Gidon a stumbling block. It became a terrible thing because instead of becoming the great focus of the victory, it was something which would improve maybe the status of Menashe. And in the end, what did he do? It caused terrible Avodah Zarah in the Jewish people. Why? Because of his bias. He was so determined that he didn't see the consequence of what he was producing. And that, I think, is a remarkable statement. A very true statement. Sometimes, you know, you get so involved in certain things, you just don't think it through to the end. Right? And what we're trying to suggest here is that, unfortunately, is the epitaph of Gidon. Gidon, in the end, had the issues of emunah, he had the issues of faith, he had the issues with God sending him signs and messages and whatever to try and boost him and all this, and he went through all of that, and he went through incredible experiences and the victory of the war and everything else, and in the end, what brings him, as it were, down to earth in a very big way, unfortunately, the tremendous bias, which I can't even blame him for that. You know, you want your tribe, you want your people to be recognized for what they are, for what they should be. But as a consequence, it blinded him to the potential danger of what he was doing, making an Eitzah, which will become so bad for the nation, not for his tribe necessarily, but for the whole Jewish people. He didn't see that. He didn't think it through. And he made this thing, and of course, as soon as he dies, then we've got a disaster over here. You'll see, you'll look at chapter 9, this guy Abimelech, he actually, I'm just to tell you, he kills off the whole of Gideon's family. Unbelievable. 70 sons, he kills them all. Because he's the, how should we say, he usurps the throne, right?
Except one,
that's right, there was one. 69 he kills, and the one who stays alive, and there's a whole interaction. We'll talk about this Nitzah maybe in 2 weeks' time. Alright? Gideon, I don't know what to say. I'm excited by Gideon, and I suppose I have to sound disappointed by Gideon. Right? Maybe that's, I don't know, how many political leaders can you say that? How many religious leaders? You get excited by them, but unfortunately sometimes you get disappointed as well. Kind of realistic, yeah.
You wrote Tosafot?
Yeah, yeah.
Is that a follower of Tosafot?
Tosafot, yeah. They're called the Tosafot school.
And
yeah.
He's saying outright...
He's saying, what is that? Is that
how?
Yeah, again, on the basis of the quote, the source, but it doesn't fit into the context whatsoever. So I suppose you're going to have to say, not that he intended it to be idolatrous, but you have to lay the blame with him because it became idolatrous.
Is that what he's saying?
I think that's... I have to interpret it like that. Otherwise, not. One of the strangest, as I said, really strange story of Gideon. I don't know what they put on his paper at the end, but you can imagine it was a kind of a mixed message at the end. The moral of the story, I don't know, Nigiyaz, you know, bias is sometimes we get blinded by it. I don't know what to say. That's a kind of a message in itself. One of the greats, we're focusing, Netz Hashem, in 2 weeks' time. As I said, we'll run very quickly through Avimelech, get some idea of this story. I'm not going to dwell on it too much because it really is quite depressing. We will get to Yiftach. Yiftach is again, a whole different ballgame. A different style of leadership completely. Netz Hashem, that will be in 2 weeks. Next week there's no share. As we continue, Netz Hashem, in 2 weeks' time. Thank you, everybody.